Today on Renewing Your Mind, a call to conscience.
William Wilberforce in England lost vote after vote when he pled with Parliament for the abolition of slavery. But his voice of protest was unheeded, but he wouldn't stop. He kept calling upon Parliament to stop this ungodly activity of slavery.
Many issues in our own day require a bold stand like the one that William Wilberforce took in the 19th century. Today on Renewing Your Mind, a message from Dr. R.C. Sproul that will remind us that the Apostle Paul stood for what was right, even to the point of death. We continue Dr. Sproul's verse-by-verse series through the book of Acts today, and as we open to chapter 14, we'll see that standing for the truth has always been controversial, but necessary. So let's listen now to Dr. Sproul as he preached from the pulpit of St. Andrew's Chapel, where he served in pastoral ministry for 2 decades.
We have seen in previous weeks of our study of the book of Acts that everywhere the apostles went to proclaim the gospel, God blessed their ministry by giving them fruit, many being converted and added to the church. And yet the pattern is the same in every city they go, that there always arises a certain level of hostility and opposition against the proclamation of the Word of God. And we read this morning that that opposition became so severe that the Jews rose up in fury against Paul and, holding a kangaroo court, used the means of capital punishment of the Old Testament law, stoning, in their attempt to execute Paul. Think for a moment of what that manner of execution is like. We can pass over it lightly, forgetting how brutal it is to be standing exposed before an angry mob, each one with large rocks in their hands, that they begin to pelt and pummel the apostle as he stands there, and rocks are hitting him in the head, in the face, in the body, tearing his flesh asunder until he is knocked unconscious to the ground. And thinking that he was dead, his people who were opposed to him grabbed him by the feet and dragged him outside of the city, leaving him there for dead. And we read, however, that he was not dead apparently, and as the disciples gathered around him and ministered to him, he was revived and was able then to move on to the next city. I have a question this morning. How many of you have been stoned and left for dead because of the proclamation of your faith? How many of you have been burned at the stake? How many of you have been used as human torches to illumine the gardens of Nero? How many of you have been sentenced to the Circus Maximus, there to be fodder for roaring lions or for the sport of gladiators? We know that it is the blood of the martyrs that has been the seed of the church. We sang this morning about the faith of our fathers, which led them to dungeons, to death, and to all sorts of peril. But we don't live in a place like that. We have freedom of assembly in the United States, and so none of us are subjected to these perils in our time. Is it because suddenly the world is more open to the proclamation of the gospel? Or is it because, in a very real sense, the church militant has become the church impotent as we seek a safe way to experience our faith? In a sense, beloved, we've made a deal with the devil. We have agreed to practice our faith, as it were, on a reservation that is removed from the public square. And we are told that as long as we keep our faith private and personal, and not intrude into the public arena, we will be able to exercise our First Amendment rights in terms of the free exercise of religion. But at the same time, we've been told that if we behave like this, then all of the financial support that we give to the church in terms of our tithes and offerings will be tax deductible, and we can use it to write off certain indebtedness on our income tax as long as we don't mix politics with our religion. We are forbidden by law in the church to support any candidate that is up for election based on the axiom that has become the dominating axiom in our culture of the separation of church and state. I hope you all realize that there's not a single word of such separation in the Constitution of the United States or in the Declaration of Independence. That phrase found its origin in a private comment of Thomas Jefferson, who even when he was using it, was talking in terms about not having one denomination or one religion established as a state church. But in our day, what separation of church and state has come to mean is the separation of state from God. That God is to have nothing to do with secular affairs of government. That God is not sovereign over the government. Nothing could be further from the purposes upon which this country was founded. We can argue indefinitely as to whether our founding fathers were Christians or deists or what they were, but one thing is certain is that they embraced theism. And they saw that the government, just as the church, was to be under God. This past week, this has been very much in the news because a couple of weeks ago or so, we know that in one Baptist church, one of the candidates for office appeared in the Sunday morning worship, and there was obviously an endorsement of that candidate in the midst of the worship service, for which the ACLU had a hissy fit, and they began to question whether or not the tax-exempt status of that Baptist church would be removed. Well, let me tell you what. In one sense, I applaud the Baptists to have the courage not to make a deal with the IRS and not to let the government tell them whom they can endorse and whom they cannot endorse, what they can say from the pulpit and what they can't say from the pulpit, because that profoundly undermines the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. Just this past week, Julian Bond spoke on behalf of the NAACP and gave a moving, passionate speech also in favor of a particular candidate and his policies. Immediately afterward, the IRS began an investigation to perhaps remove the tax-exempt charter of the NAACP. Well, I don't always agree with Julian Bonds, but I think the NAACP should certainly have the right to proclaim their position on issues of this magnitude to their people without being threatened with the loss of their tax exemption. But that tax exemption is the sword that is held over the church and over nonprofit organizations to keep them from being critical of the government and the government's policies. That's not a good thing. And I hope that as Christians we would be willing to risk our tax write-off for the sake of righteousness. If the only reason we give our tithes and our offerings to the church is that because it gives us a tax write-off, I guarantee you God won't be pleased with your gift. We are to give those gifts whether or not the government gives us any break in terms of our taxes. So having said that, let me suggest to you today that I'm going to come perilously close to crossing the line. I believe that I am supposed to submit to the civil magistrates even when I disagree with them. So I will not endorse a candidate, but I'm going to teach you, or I'm going to try to influence you in how you vote. Because the Word of God has much to say that we ought to see as being instructive for how we vote. The first thing is this. We have to understand what a vote is, ladies and gentlemen. The word vote comes from the Latin votum, which means will. We have an opportunity in our country to express our will by casting our vote in favor of what we want to see happen in terms of government. In a very real, though invisible sense, a principle of that vote that is often ignored, but nevertheless real. In a real sense, the ballot is a bullet. Because anytime you cast your vote, you are asking that certain policies and laws be enacted that are backed and enforced by the full magnitude of the power of civil government. And so be careful. Be thoughtful. The purpose of voting is not for what we can get from the government for ourselves. We are to vote for what is right, not for our own personal gain, in order for me to receive it. Please remember that, ladies and gentlemen. The government doesn't produce anything. The government can't give to anybody what they don't first take away from somebody else. And when you vote for your own largesse, you are asking the government to use all of its force to take from your brother and sister their private property and give it to you. Let me give you an example of this. I was in Mississippi several years ago. I was staying at a hotel. And while I was at the hotel, there was a convention, a state convention of the Mississippi Pork Producers Society. And all around the hotel, affixed to the walls and bulletin boards, were large pie graphs. And the pie graphs were divided into segments or slices, and each segment showed how the Mississippi pork producers were using the government subsidies that they were given for their private business. And far and away, the largest block in the pie was the monies that were used to promote and advertise pork as the meat of choice. Now, let's think about this. First thing the pork producers thought about doing was this. They first went to the Beef Producers Association, and they said, look, let's all get along. You guys have basically cornered the market. People in America prefer beef over pork, and we're having a hard time meeting our payrolls. How about you guys donating $800,000 of your profit to us so that we can go to the market and tell the people in the market that they should buy pork rather than beef? What do you think the beef people would say to such a request? I pass on that one. So then the next thing the pork producers decide to do is that they say, well, maybe we can just in the dead of night go over there and steal $800,000 from the cattle producers and use it for our private industry. I said, but somebody said, but if we do that and we get caught, we'll go to jail because it's against the law to steal. And then somebody else says, well, I got an idea. What? Let's go to the government and ask the government to take $800,000 from the profits of the cattlemen and give it to us. We'll still get the same money. We compete on an even playing field, and it's all perfectly legal. And it's perfectly legal, it's also perfectly immoral and unethical for you to ask the government for a special subsidy for your private enterprise. That's sin. And yet it's the American way. Washington is filled with lobby groups that do this every day. And they ask for legislation not for what is right, not as what is for good, what is good for the welfare of the nation. It is for their vested interests. And voting your vested interest as a Christian is a sin. And I plead with you not to join in this activity in this country. Several years ago, I had dinner with the chairman of the Senate Financing Committee, the United States Senate that allocates monies. We had a cordial conversation. In the midst of the conversation, I said to him, "Senator, why don't you do such and such? Seems it desperately needs to be done in Washington." And he looked at me, and with all earnestness, he said, "R.C., you're absolutely right." He said, "That has to be done. But we can't do it this year." I said, "Why not?" He said, "It's an election year." So I went to the next question. I said, "Well, why don't you fellows do this, this, and this?" He said, "Boy, you're right on that. That's long past needed. But not this year." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because it's an election year." This went on for an hour. I asked him, without exaggerating, at least 15 times this type of question, and 15 times in a row, he told me they couldn't do what he agreed should be done because it was an election year. And I said to him, "Senator, is there anybody in Washington, anybody, who's thinking about the next generation instead of the next election?" This is a serious, serious problem in our nation. When Alexis de Tocqueville came and examined the great experiment of America, he said, "It's a wonderful thing that's going on here, but there are two things that can kill it." He said, "The first thing is when people understand that the ballot is worth money, so that the rich and powerful can buy their way into office and use their wealth and power to exploit the poor." He said, "That'll destroy America if that happens." So the other thing that could happen is if people discover that they can vote for themselves largesse. They can go to the trough and ask the government to fill it for them and take public money to themselves. He said either one of those will destroy a nation and turn it into the tyranny of the majority. Beloved, here's how that happens. When economics are politicized. Let me say it again. Here's how it happens. When economics are politicized, where you encourage people to vote their pocketbooks rather than your conscience. I heard one candidate in this presidential race who has said again and again that what he plans to do is to create a tax relief program for 98% of Americans. And I've heard him challenged again and again and again by people saying, "Well, what'll that do to the small businessman and so on?" I haven't heard anybody ask the obvious question. Has somebody taken the blindfold off of Lady Justice? Are we no longer equal under the law? Nobody said, "Well, if you're going to cut the taxes of 98% of them, why wouldn't you do it for 100% of the people?" Well, there's one, the 2% up there, they can afford it. Oh, and we're going to change the laws against theft. We're going to say it's a felony to steal anybody's automobile unless they can afford it. One of the things that's so beautiful about how God did it was this. He says we're going to have a level playing field, really level, equitable, and just. Everybody in my kingdom is going to be required to pay the same percentage. No graduated or progressive income tax in Israel. Nobody can play politics with the tithe. Everybody, same percentage. Now, some people may pay 100 times more than another person, but at least they're paying the same percentage. And here's what God would not allow. He would not allow somebody to vote a tax on his neighbor that was not a tax on himself. If you vote for a 98% tax reduction, that's what you're doing is you're saying, "I'm voting for a tax on 2% that I don't have to pay." That's not justice. That's not equitable. It's legalized theft. And we do it every single day. But far more important than the economic issues is the single most important ethical issue that we face in this election. It's the same issue we faced for the last several elections since the early 70s. I remember William Wilberforce in England lost vote after vote after vote year in and year out when he pled with Parliament for the abolition of slavery. But slavery was so connected to the economic welfare of England that his voice of crying and protest was unheeded year after year after year. But he wouldn't stop. He kept arguing. He kept pleading. He kept calling upon Parliament to have a conscience to stop this ungodly activity of man and woman stealing and slavery, until finally England's conscience was moved and slavery was abolished. I think slavery is the second worst ethical issue ever to divide the United States of America. But even more serious than slavery is the governmental sanction on the wanton destruction of 1.5 million unborn human beings every year in this nation. I'm not running, and I won't accept the draft. But I'll tell you, when I've written 60 books, and of the books that I've written, the one with the shortest shelf life, the one that went out of print first, was the book, The Case Against Abortion. We provided educational materials for churches, and pastors wouldn't use them and ask them why. And they said, because it will divide the congregation. And I said, so what? Let it divide the congregation. We're talking about the sanctity of life here. And the first century church in the Didache, one of the most important extra-canonical books of the early church, didn't shrink from calling abortion what it is, murder, and said that the church can never possibly be involved in that sort of thing. But it's become part of the acceptable fabric of America today. And nobody's crying foul. The church is not asking at this point for the state to become the church. When we tell the state, stop sanctioning this murder, this Holocaust, what we're doing is we're asking the state to be the state. Because the primary reason for the existence of the state in the first place is to protect, to maintain, and sustain the sanctity of human life. When a state ceases to do that, that state is not simply pagan, it's barbarian. And I know when we look at the issues in the presidential election, you know, we see what are the most important things on the agenda. People say, well, it's Iraq, or it's terrorism, or it's the economy, or it's this, this. Way down at the bottom of the list is abortion. And I'll tell you this, I couldn't sleep. I could not sleep if I ever cast a ballot, ever, for a candidate who supported abortion on demand. That trumps every other ethical issue that we're faced with in our time. And I plead with you as Christians, when you walk into the voting booth this Tuesday, don't leave your Christianity in the parking lot. Let your mind be informed by the Word of God. Now, it's possible that I'm wrong and that God is perfectly okay with abortion on demand. But I've been studying theology all my life, and if I know anything about the character of God, I know that God hates abortion. And there are other ways to deal with unwanted pregnancies than the physical destruction of the unborn. So when you go to vote, and I hope you will vote, I hope you will vote your conscience, not your vested interest, not your pocketbooks, but that you will vote for righteousness and for justice as your conscience is informed by the Word of God. Until or unless we do that, God will give us leaders after our own hearts, which is a scary thing.
Dr. R.C. Sproul was never a political activist. That was not the thrust of his ministry at St. Andrew's Chapel, nor here at Ligonier Ministries. But he was passionate about those issues that the Bible is clear about. R.C. always said that it was not the church's responsibility to call the state to be the church, but it was the church's responsibility to call the state to be the state, to protect life. Well, before we go today, I'd like to let you know about our offer. Dr. Sproul wrote a helpful booklet titled, What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? It provides a detailed description of salvation, how it occurs, and how we grow as Christians. For your gift of any amount today, we will send you two copies of this booklet. Our number is 800-435-4343, or you can give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. Our goal here at Ligonier Ministries is to help you grow in your faith. And as you grow, we hope you'll effectively share your faith as well. That's why we're making this book available. Again, contact us with your gift of any amount. We will send you two copies of What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? Our number again is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Well, next weekend, we'll return to Dr. Sproul's verse-by-verse sermon series in the book of Acts. We'll be in chapter 15, where the church faces a threat from the Judaizers. We hope you'll join us next Sunday here on Renewing Your Mind.